known as the Dash-8. It is a twin-engine turboprop that is normally used as a passenger plane. I've flown on Dash-8. It's a 60-seat airliner. At first glance, you might mistake it for, you know, a 1950s era, you know, airliner that had two or four, you know, piston engines and 60 passengers, but this is two turboprops, 60 passengers. That's about 400 miles an hour. The ones I was on gave me a very nice ride. I really enjoyed the flight. But apparently the Japanese Coast Guard has a number of them, and this particular one had six people on it. And the air traffic controller had the plane wait right off the same runway that the airliner, the Airbus in question was about to land on. Let me drop. Let's do a little bit of airport geometry, as I didn't know 24 hours ago, but I have since learned. This airport has a couple of runways and a batch of taxiways. And taxiway C parallels the runway in question. And there are a number of points where you can go from the taxiway and just do a little, you know, dog leg onto the runway. And then numbered from C1 up to, I don't know, like C8 or something. And this Dash-80, being a twin-engine turboprop, doesn't need that whole runway. And what they sometimes do is have planes get on the runway a little, you know, they don't go all the way to the start. They kind of go in up a little bit. And air traffic control told the Coast Guard plane to hold at C5, making it very clear that in a moment or two, he would give them the go-ahead to pull onto the runway and take off. Now, it was obvious that in aviation, before you take off, you know, particularly a large airport like that, you're always assuming there's incoming planes. So they'll often tell you something like, you know, they'll wait till after the incoming plane lands, and they'll have a bit of a gap, and they'll say, okay, you're on the runway now, we'll go. Obviously not using that language. Let me let it drop. Now, there's another item. Not only was the Coast Guard plane crew completely exhausted and stressed out, in all probability, I have no proof of that, but I assume based on the earthquake they were, there's another known fact. At large airports, they have various systems to prevent what are known as runway incursions. Somebody, for whatever reason, going on a runway when they shouldn't. And one of these is something I will get any pilots upset about by calling this a stoplight. At point C5, there's a traffic light. So when they tell you to hold at C5, as you pull up, there's a red light. And then they will tell you to go, and then I'm not sure exactly if the red light turns green or what, but the problem is, things like that, airports are full of things like that, and every once in a while, one of them needs maintenance. So it's fairly common to have a system like that out of order, and in most cases, there are enough backups and the like that it's not a showstopper. And I read in the press that they filed a NOTAM, which is, you know, a standard formal notification. But an airport that size probably has 1,000 outstanding NOTAMs, and nobody can pay close attention to 1,000 of these things. But the air traffic controller certainly had a there's no stoplight at C5. Let me drop. Now, here's where I'm stepping on thin ice. If you're an air traffic controller, And you know one safety system is down. And you probably, you damn well know there was an earthquake. And it's reasonable to assume the Coast Guard people are stressed out and exhausted. You would think that the air traffic controller would try to make a point to, you know, just be a little careful with them, knowing they have, like, you know, two strikes against them. Now, I did hear on a YouTube thing, they did have some of the stuff, and I was kind of taken by the air traffic controller. I heard it. Now, first of all, let me drop again. Hold on. By international law, the decision was made many years ago. All international air traffic radio communication is in English. So at Tokyo, a major international airport, anywhere in the world, they speak English. Problem is, a lot of the air traffic controllers, you know, English is obviously not their first language, and they have fairly thick Japanese accents. And I heard that this fellow who told them to hold the C-5 had a fairly thick Japanese accent. And I just get the flavor that he really was a little bit brusque and not really, like, you know, reminding them. And apparently, now, standard protocol is when the air traffic controller tells you, as a pilot, hold the C-5, you respond back. Now, if you're just pulling up the C-5, you say, hold the C-5, you know, you identify and hold the C-5. If you have a bit to go, you let them know, and then you repeat, you know, then you say, hold the C-5. Now, it may have, I just heard a little clip, an excerpt, and it's possible they did respond, but I didn't hear it. They may have just cut it off after, you know, to hold the C-5, and boom, they cut it off. I don't know, but there was no response. And the proper protocol is for the controller to assume something went wrong and repeat, hold at C-5 until the plane responds. And either he would say, holding a C-5, or he might possibly say, oh my God, I misinterpreted. At which point, the air traffic controller say, you know, to the Airbus, abort immediately, you know, go around. And if he responds, it's too late. You know, just make sure they both know what's going on so they can do whatever they can to mitigate the damage. It's possible the Airbus, if they had known what's happening, might have done an intentional run off the runway onto the grass, knowing it would crash the plane, but it would be survivable. Gary, any thoughts?
Who's Gary?
I'm sorry, Roy, I'm thinking of something else. Brain fart. Roy.
Okay. It sounds reasonable. I would assume air accidents are such that you learn a lot more as time goes on. These guys don't kind of take any of this flippantly, so there'll be a lot of published interpretations of very technical reports. We'll see what develops. It's a shame that these things happen, but human beings, unfortunately, tend to be fallible creatures.
220 to the comment.
Hi, he's back.
Sure, Hank.
It's Nick, Kids Kilo 2 in November Tango Hotel.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's all right. You told Roy what he did wrong. Now you tell me what I did wrong, because I'm not an airline pilot.
No, good. I mean, you gave a good summary. And interestingly, I was actually at Haneda yesterday, coming back with my family and from Japan, and we had to actually land in San Francisco to get fuel because the runway that this occurred on was still closed, and the remaining runways were too short for us to take on enough fuel. So we had to stop in San Francisco for fuel on the way back yesterday. But I was going to offer a quick perspective on it as well. One second. So I think this accident is a good example of kind of what's referred to as the Swiss cheese model, in the sense that, you know, it's said that aviation accidents happen when a number of, you know, things line up. Most systems in aviation are designed to tolerate one or even sometimes multiple failures, but there's a whole bunch of things that kind of went wrong in this case. And, you know, you sort of highlighted the original one is right. The Dash 8 pilot entered an active runway without a clearance, which is sort of a bit of the, you know, obviously the big no-no, and the real root cause here is that the Dash 8 was on the runway without a clearance, and that should not have happened. But there was a couple of other things, you know, you kind of highlighted that kind of lined up in that Swiss cheese model that kind of, you know, contributed to this as well. Let me drop. One of them was that where they entered the runway was not at the end of the runway. It was further down the runway, right around where the landing aircraft would have landed. And if you look at a map, this runway has a kind of weird configuration, and the Dash 8 doesn't need the full runway length. And so one of the unfortunate things is it had the runway incursion right where the airplane was landing. If they had, say, taxied out on the runway at the threshold end, the landing aircraft would have probably just passed right over top of them. So that was kind of like one element of the Swiss cheese model. You mentioned the runway lights, the whole short bar was out of service, so that was a visual indicator that wasn't there. It happened at night. You know, it was very hard for the landing aircraft to see. Apparently as well, the Dash 8 is very difficult to see from behind, so the landing airliner probably didn't see the aircraft until it was way too late. And lastly, there's some questions about whether Haneda or Tokyo International, as they now call it, has some of the latest technology on ground radar. Make a final comment there, one second. And so the ground radar, which they have at airports like JFK, for example, it basically is an autonomous system that uses a radar technology to monitor aircraft arriving or departing, and completely separate from the air traffic controller, will illuminate a series of red lights across all the entryways to an active runway. The next time you're leaving from JFK, you can look for this, where as an airplane is approaching or getting ready to take off, these red lights appear at the end of the runway to sort of tell somebody to not enter that runway because there's an aircraft on approach. And I believe this runway doesn't have that, but it's something that the FAA, certainly in the U.S., is pushing for all major airports to be getting, because it helps as an extra check on top of the air traffic controllers to have a separate computer system that will just display a big red stoplight to stop an aircraft from entering a runway if it detects that somebody is taking off or landing on that runway. So I'll pause there, but those are just a bunch of other kind of unfortunate contributing factors that led to that accident.
Excellent. I learned a few things there, but I do have a couple of comments. First, I hope you haven't copyrighted your Swiss cheese model, because I think it was the New York Times had an article somewhere. My son sent me an article on that very subject, using that very terminology, the Swiss cheese model. Yes, absolutely. But I did not know that a Dash 8 is kind of hard to see from the rear, to which somebody who doesn't know that C5 comes in at a 45-degree angle might say, what do you mean, it was to the side? No, C5 is an angled approach. I saw the runway map, and he was waiting at like a 45-degree angle, so if this hadn't happened in another minute, he would have been told to taxi onto the runway and make a half left. So that's why the incoming plane had that restricted view if they don't show up that well from the rear. Thanks for that. I did not know that.
Sure, yeah. No, I certainly have not copyrighted the Swiss cheese model. It's a pretty common phrase that's used, but it is a good analogy for how these things tend to compile on top of each other.
And in a total ridiculous coincidence, before I read the article or heard you this morning, we got up and the SYL says to me, you know what, I really have a hankering for, can you make me a Swiss cheese omelet? And since then, it's been all Swiss cheese today.
KD2VHT.
Jim, I hope you're not complaining about that terrible line.
No, I enjoyed it tremendously. No derogatory comments whatsoever. But I will say that it's interesting that the streak that runs through these things is that management models that presume people will be perfect are perfect failures every time.
Wait a minute. We have discussed so many systems that are the opposite of that. Let me show you. All right. Yeah, there's the thing I call the stoplight, you know, the hold bar. There was the airport radar. There's the air traffic controller. The problem is, you know, the Swiss cheese model says, you know, you get enough minor imperfections, you get one major of oops.
Maybe we're talking the same thing, but I think sometimes these systems that we put trust in assume people will do the job perfectly. I've yet to see that ever, like it once, not any one single instance in my whole life, ever. And that needs to be accounted for. It's just the nature of the beast.
Good old Sully wasn't perfect, but he was certainly close enough. If you want me to elaborate on a not perfect, sure.
I'd love that. Go ahead.
First of all, you recognize my point.
I think so.
You know, when the plane, you know, with Sullenberger, the Miracle on the Hudson, when the plane hit a flock of geese at 3,000 feet and lost all engine power, and in the end, not only nobody died, nobody was even really seriously hurt. I think the biggest thing was, you know, exposure, because it was like 14 degrees. But there was a movie made of this that a lot of people were very upset by, that they showed that the inquiry was very, very hostile. And the reality was, the inquiry was along the lines of, you did great. You're wonderful. On the other hand, we're sure you're not perfect. Let's go through it piece by piece. Let's see what you did right, what you did wrong, and then we'll understand, in case this ever happens again, maybe we'll know how to do it right the first time. And there was a case of that. Now, I could not give you chapter and verse of the mistakes he made, but they did find small stuff. It was small stuff. It was not game-changing. But they did find a few things that, looking at it with 20/20 hindsight, everybody, including Sully, said, yeah, I should have done that, but didn't think of it.
Well, any sane person that's ever flown in out of LaGuardia that pays attention to, like, simple things like angles and banks and neighborhoods and life hazards and humans in the flight path would say, there's no way this should be that there should be an airport there. It's ridiculous. It's totally ridiculous. I've flown into that place a couple times, and I'm like, you know, this is like the Lancaster bombers trying to do skip bombing to the dams in Amsterdam or wherever the hell they did that. It's insanity to fly into that place. But we do it every day, apparently. And I've done it multiple times, and they make it work. But when it goes wrong, you can't go, we couldn't imagine. Because if you couldn't imagine, you're an idiot.
Do you want to hear my little bit of heresy?
I do, if Roy approves.
Yeah, fine. It's just kind of make it short because I'm feeling guilty about the SpaceNet report.
Oh, quite short. I have felt this for a while, and I bounced this off of other people, and at first, their question, but then they kind of come along. why did Sully reject just about any runway out of hand and pick the Hudson? And Jim, you alluded to it. When you're flying to LaGuardia, you're flying over some of the most heavily, densely populated turf in the world. And if he tried to go back to LaGuardia and didn't make it, he could have crashed in some of the most heavily populated parts of the world and killed thousands on the ground. And that's why he said, I want the Hudson.
Thoughts, no arguments. I'll put it back to Roy.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Ed, for this very interesting talk. Thank you, Jim. Thank you, Nick. Thank you, everyone who participated. It's now a good time for the Space Net Report with WS2N. So, Paul, take it away.
Go ahead.
Very good topic, guys. WS2N. Thank you, Roy. I'm absorbed listening to all these plane stories. Very good. Very, very well done. Yeah, I've been following it on the news as well, but it's nice to get more definitive answers here. SpaceNet report. For the first net of the new year involves a new rocket that's never flown before. Over about 10 years ago, NASA decided that they needed to develop a new rocket to replace not only the Atlas V, which is a workhorse of NASA, which has launched over 100 missions with that, along with the Delta IV Heavy. They need to replace that as well. And what they're going to replace it with is the Vulcan rocket. They needed brand new engines because the Atlas V was running RD-180 engines, which are Russian engines. And back in 2014, once Crimea got invaded by the Russians, big movement to get away from Russian technology in general, including rocketry. RD-180 engines just never failed. Excellent engines, actually built partially in the Ukraine as well. But they needed a newer set of engines. They came up with the BE-4. BE-4 is an engine that's built by Blue Origin, and it can get thrust up to 550,000 pounds of thrust at full throttle. And they decided, well, we're going to put two of these things inside the new Vulcan rocket. They had the RD-180s, and the RD-180, although you see two big nozzles sticking out of the bottom, what it really was one engine. It just had two combustion chambers. And now when you look at the bottom of the new Vulcan rocket, you're going to see two nozzles as well, but they're going to be two separate engines, two BE-4 engines. By Blue Origin. Blue Origin, of course, is owned by Jeff Bezos. Now, these engines, unlike the RD-180s, which ran on kerosene and liquid oxygen, the BE-4s run on liquid methane and liquid oxygen. So there's a big difference there. Liquid methane is easier to get, and it's also cleaner. It's a cleaner burn. In the long run, they plan on taking the BE-4s of the Vulcan and actually reusing them. But for this first flight that's coming up, very shortly, by the way, it's coming up at 2:18 this morning, tomorrow morning, January 8th, a couple of few hours from now, will be the inaugural launch of the Vulcan rocket. It also has a new upper stage, which is not liquid methane, but liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. They're running RL-10 C engines, which are engines that have been around literally for decades. They've just been improved over the years. They started developing these things probably in the 1960s, I guess. And they just got better in time. There's two of them that are mounted on the upper stage. They have the capability of relighting, putting the payloads into different orbits with the new Vulcan rocket. The rocket's also going to be assisted by solid booster rockets, brand new ones made by Northrop Grumman. Northrop Grumman has produced these. They call them GEM 63s. GEM is an acronym for graphite epoxy motors, and the 63 stands for the diameter of these things. And they're about seven stories tall. They're going to be putting two of them on the Vulcan rocket. And the thrust of each one is around, well, each one is around 500,000 pounds of thrust. So, you know, you team the two engines and from the B-4s and the two solids, and they think they're going to be getting around 100, and I think they said 1.7 million pounds of thrust capability. Vulcan rocket in the future will also be able to take more solids on board as well. They'll be able to take two or four or even six. So this new rocket that's going to be replacing two of the existing rockets that exist today will be a real workhorse for the future. They'll be able to do orbital missions. They'll be able to do lunar missions, interplanetary missions as well. Also, they'll be able to launch people. This thing is human rated. In the future, you're going to take the Starliner that that Boeing has been building to carry a crew of four. Their first couple flights will be on the old Atlas V, but eventually that will be shifted over to the Vulcan rocket. And the destination for that spacecraft with a crew up to four would be the International Space Station. They would do rotations with SpaceX. SpaceX now does it with every 5 or 6 months they launch a new crew up, four at a time. So they roughly twice a year. And once the new Vulcan rocket is running with the new Starliner, each company would be able to send a crew up once a year. You'll now have two vehicles that could dock with the International Space Station. And also future stations as well that are planned. They'll have that capability to dock with them. So tomorrow's mission, or actually a couple hours from now, is the Peregrine lunar lander. It's built by Astrobotic. Astrobotic is the company that's headquartered in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And they built the Peregrine lunar lander. So it's actually a private mission. That thing has not been funded by NASA, although NASA gives these companies seed money. These are all private companies. They have they got the primary spot on this rocket. I think they're really rolling the dice. You know, they have real confidence in this. Everybody does. Boeing and Lockheed, who are in charge of the rocket, it's called ULA, United Launch Alliance, have a lot of faith in this launch. And Astrobotic, putting their first Peregrine lander on the rocket, have faith in it as well. So if it goes up, it should eventually get into lunar orbit, and hopefully we'll have a lander. This is not going to go to the South Pole. It's going to go more to a little northern latitude, and we'll see how if this is successful. We have a lot of different science equipment on board the lander. The lander stands about 6 feet tall, and you know it's a 8 foot cube on the bottom. It's got legs that really look sturdy, and the legs happen to be built by Airbus. I heard Ed talking about Airbus before with their airplane. That's a big company. Airbus is not really getting into space type of work as well. They plan on being a partner in a new space station, brand new space station. They're partnered with an American company called Voyager, and they're both going to be funding it, but primarily run by Voyager. And their goal is to have a completely independent space station, different than the ISS, and hope to have it up in the air by 2030. So a lot of things going on. We'll hope to see Peregrine land. I believe they said it's going to go into a long elliptical orbit around the moon first, and then with its own engines, it will eventually circularize that and eventually get themselves down to 100 kilometers, which is roughly 60 miles above the surface. And that is the common height that a lot of the all the Apollo missions eventually found themselves at, 60-mile range. And that's where the command module stayed, and the lens went down to the surface and came back up. And so that's a popular elevation. So they'll find themselves in that orbit, and when they're good and ready, and it looks like they're predicting February 23rd, they'll be going down to the moon to try to do the first landing by the United States since 1972, when Apollo 17 went to the moon in that December. Of course, this one is uncrewed, but it's still a U.S. mission. But it's a little different than, like I said, a government NASA mission. This is a private company. Astrobotic is building other landers as well. They have one planned later this year as well, but they plan on launching. So we'll see how that goes. Let me drop it, see if there's any comments, questions. WS2N. Okay, nothing heard. Now, a couple of weeks ago, normally I would have reported this a week or two ago, but we've been away from the SpaceNet report for a few weeks because of Christmas and New Year's. But on December 22nd, Firefly, another new rocket company, launched its fourth rocket called the Alpha Rocket. And they launched out of Vandenberg Air Force Base, and they actually flew west, southwest from Vandenberg with their new Alpha Rocket. They've had some little problems with a couple of the Alpha Rockets that they've launched. The third one was very successful to a point, and then they have some little problems with the upper stage. But good enough to get the payloads into proper orbit. On the fourth one, they have a little problem as well. They couldn't circularize the orbit. The second stage did not relight. And the customer was Lockheed. Lockheed decided that they wanted to send up a new type of antenna to test an antenna This is a phase type of antenna. And they want to see how it went. And they thought they needed a circular orbit. But Firefly was unable to do that. But anyway, they were able to test out their new antenna anyway. But it's an upcoming company. They fly, right now there's no boosters attached or anything like that. But they have bigger plans in the future. They have lunar landers that they're working on, lunar orbiters. So I'm looking forward to see how Firefly works out. This is their, like I said, their fourth flight. The government has contracted with them for instant launches of satellites. When I say instant, within 24 hours. They want to be able to call up a company. When I say they, the government wants to call up a company and say, we need a spy satellite put up, like, tomorrow. And they need a company that can do that. So they contracted with Firefly to see if that was capable of doing that. And they did that a couple of flights ago. You know, they called them up. We need this thing launched within 24 hours. And we have a satellite that's on the way. And sure enough, they were able to do that, which is a good thing. Because, you know, in case of you have military problems, you know, somebody decides to shoot a communication satellite out of orbit, they want to be able to, you know, or maybe interfere with it with, you know, with a signal or something, they could replace that in a quick amount of time. So that's a story with Firefly. They have, I'm not going to go into their engines and all, but it's not a reusable vehicle. It's throwaway. It is liquid oxygen and RP-1, which is rocket propellant 1, which is kerosene that they use. They're not using the modern methane that a lot of companies are going with. We'll see. That's another thing with that Vulcan rocket. When that goes up, that'll be the first American rocket to use the liquid methane to get to orbit. SpaceX has been trying it for the last, who knows how many flights, I guess, last two launches with their Starliner flight. That's liquid methane. They have not achieved orbit yet. If Vulcan is successful, that'll be a big plus for Blue Origin with the BE-4 engine. The BE-4 engine is also going to be used for the New Glenn that Blue Origin is building. They hope to get that off the ground maybe by the end of the year. They're predicting that, I'm going to guess, probably early 2025. But that engine, that first stage will have 7 of these things on the bottom. Same ones that they use them for the Vulcan rocket. They have 2. These people are going to have 7. The only difference is the New Glenn will not be carrying any boosters, as far as I know at this time. So they'll be getting a lot of thrust with their 7 BE-4 engines. So we'll see if New Glenn can get off the ground by the end of the year, or hopefully by December. Again, I'm going to guess probably next January. Okay. I think I covered this a couple of times, in the weeks past, or at least talked about this topic. This has to do with the communication with laser. I think I went over this many, many times, that NASA was planning to do with one of their deep space spacecraft. in this case, Psyche. Psyche is a spacecraft that was launched not too long ago, and that's a very large spacecraft, and, you know, with solar panels that are 84 feet wide. That's on the way to the Trojan system of Jupiter, roughly Jupiter's orbit, and it's going to take many years to get there, probably, correction, let me think about this. Psyche is going to Psyche is going to the asteroid belt. I'm conflating that with another mission going out to the asteroids in the Trojan system. Psyche is going to the asteroid Psyche, also in the asteroid belt. So that's the mission for that. But on board, they had this transmitter, this 4-watt infrared laser transmitter, laser light that they could point back to Earth. And it also had a receiver. So the goal was to transmit from Earth. They were going to transmit from Tabletop Mountain in California, transmit a 5,000-watt laser up to the spacecraft. The spacecraft was supposed to pick up that signal and use that to hone in on pointing their 4-watt infrared laser back to Earth, which they did. And they transmitted to another location about 100 miles away from Tabletop Mountain, the Hale telescope. So they did that. Hale telescope picked up that laser, decoded the photons, and then sent it on to JPL. And there, they were able to detect the pre-programmed transmission from Psyche. Now, this is all being done at 10 million miles away. By the way, it's already, like, I don't know, 40 million miles away now, inside of a couple of weeks. But this was done at 10 million miles away, which is a lot further than the moon. That was the record. They did have a laser transmit from the moon a while back, from the orbit of the moon. This, you know, that's only a quarter of a million miles away. This was 10 million miles away at the time. And they wanted to see if it would be able to send all this data back. That's a, you know, high-definition picture. I believe it was 4K with this cat that was running around chasing a little laser beam that they had previously recorded. They used somebody, one of the employees' cats, and put it onto the flash drive on Psyche, and sure enough, transmitted back to Earth, and they received the whole thing. And sure enough, you can go on the internet and view it. The amount of data that's coming back is they want a minimum of 10 times more than what you would get on RF, and this is I forget what it was, way above that number. And they'll do it again. When they get further out, they're going to try it again. Instead of 10 million miles, they'll do it at, you know, 20, probably 30 million miles. Eventually out to the orbit past Mars. You know, because the asteroid belt is much further than the orbit of Mars. The present plan is not to use it for actual data that's coming back, although they did say that they probably have that capability. This is really just a test to see not only how they could do it, but how well they're going to do it, because ultimate goal is you're going to have people on Mars. It would be great to be able to transmit back and forth to Earth video, which would be terrific. Instead of taking hours to make a video and transmit it back, you could do it real time. Of course, it's going to take time for the signals to get to Earth, even with this test at 10 million miles out. They point the laser. They have to point the laser to not where the Earth is at this time. They have had to figure, you know, 5 minutes from now, whatever it was, where the Earth is going to be. Not only where the Earth is going to be, but the laser actually had to hit a certain diameter on the Earth to be picked up by the HALT space telescope. Interesting project, but it worked. Any comments? WS2N. Intuitive Machines, another company similar to Astrobotic. Intuitive Machines is building a landing spacecraft to land on the moon called Nova C. I think I've talked about this before, but they actually have plans of going up. They thought they were going to be able to beat Astrobotic's Peregrine to the moon with their Nova C lander, but they got delayed. There was weather problems and some other delays that SpaceX had. Took them a while to get their Falcon Heavy off the ground. They probably did on what I think it was the 28th of December, but there was many delays, up to five different delays with that launch. And Intuitive Machines is being launched not by a Vulcan rocket, but by a SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket, and that will be launched from Launch Complex 39A, where they have the capability of putting liquid methane into the Intuitive Machines spacecraft. Intuitive Machines needs liquid methane, where Astrobotic doesn't. Astrobotic needs they use hypergolic fuel, means two different fuels get mixed together and they ignite all by themselves. Liquid methane is not like that, so they need an igniter. But they also need liquid methane, and the only place capable of doing that up at a very high, up near the top level, in this case, that's where the spacecraft is going to be, is at Launch Complex 39A. So with all the delays that SpaceX had, it pushed Intuitive Machines back. Nothing wrong with this spacecraft, nothing wrong with anything, everything's going well, but instead of a January possible landing, now they're looking at late February as a landing. So probably after Peregrine lands. Anyway, Nova C will be heading to the south pole of the moon. That's the goal, where Artemis will be landing in, on the initial flights. So we'll see. WS2S. You know, now this year is going to be all about not only different planets, you know, things going on out there with these spacecraft going out to distant worlds, but really the moon. A lot of things going on with the moon. There's one spacecraft, private company, in Japan. That's building a spacecraft called SLIM. Well, they built it. Not only have they built it, they've launched it. They launched it at the end of September, September 30th, I think I wrote down here. SLIM was launched by a H2 Japanese vehicle, liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen rocket, directly from Takashima spaceport in Japan. Their goal is to land SLIM on the moon. Well, we'll see if this works out. It's a relatively small vehicle, small lander. From what I read, it's on the light side too. But if they do land, it will be the first private company to successfully land. And they're shooting for January 19th, so a couple of weeks from now. We'll see. They were launched with another spacecraft at the time called CRISM. And it was spelled X-R-I-S-M. CRISM is a space telescope. And NASA went in on it with Japan building that. And it was, again, launched on the H-2A rocket. And it's, you know, it's a primary telescope that's now orbiting the Earth. But the secondary launch vehicle was this thing called SLIM, which is it's now in orbit of the moon. As of Christmas Day, it did get out of the highly elliptical orbit, let's call it the TLI, Translunar Injection, took place. It really wasn't in orbit yet. It went way past the moon, 100,000 miles past the moon, and then eventually came back, and then the gravity well of the moon picked it up. So that's why it took so long from the end of September all the way until now to get into circular orbit. As of December 25th, Christmas Day, they successfully put this thing into a circular orbit. So we'll see if SLIM makes it. If SLIM makes it, they'll be the first. Astrobotic with Peregrine will be the second. And Intuitive Machines with Nova C will be the third. And they have other ones planned. These companies are building, you know, not only two, three. I read Nova C is planning at least 8 missions, over the next couple of years. And each one more and more involved. They plan on being able to bring cargo to the South Pole. Going to have people not only... You know, in orbit around the moon with the Gateway space station, you know, that's going to have to be, you know, supplied with fuel and food and you know, water and everything. You're going to have eventually people on the moon that will, if they get extended periods of time when staying not only days but weeks or who knows how long, they're going to need to be supplied with stuff. Everything from science equipment to food. And anyway, these companies, in the back of their mind, they're thinking cargo service for NASA. And that's what they're planning. Any comments? WS to us.
B2BX, helpful.
Happy New Year, Frank. How are you?
I'm fine. I'm on Echo Link via Starlink from a cruise ship in the Caribbean heading right now between Fort Lauderdale and Jamaica. Go ahead.
Sounds great. Doing great on Echo Link. A wonderful, wonderful way to do it. Very good. On the Caribbean. Let's see. Trying to think where that rocket is going to go. No, I don't think it's going your way. It's going to go. Due east. You'd be able to see if you were further north, you'd be able to see the thing go overhead. When it leaves Florida in a couple of few hours, the Vulcan rocket. Very good. Have you been listening to the report, or you just turn it on, Frank? WB2BXO Caribbean WS2M.
Net time complete.
Yeah, I caught some of it. What I just saw on YouTube, I'm not sure if you covered it because talking to my wife in the cabin here. I just saw the CRS launch explosion on YouTube. I'm not sure how recent it was. It looked like they never made it past. They blew up at max Q. Have you seen that yet?
Which one? A cargo vehicle blew? The CRS 19? Which one was that? No, I haven't seen it. If one blew on its way up, was going through max Q? No, I haven't seen that.
Yeah, Okay, you're probably right on the number. Cygnus CRS 19 is probably the correct number. I know it was definitely Cygnus CRS. I didn't catch what the booster was, but it was one of an explosion. They called out going through Max-Q, and then the explosion filled the screen, and they said, everyone in the LCC, stay at your consoles. You know, the launch call you never want to hear. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's not good. Not good. Yeah, well, I'll look for that after the net. But, yeah. I'm trying to get a handle on what one that was. I know there was another one that went off tonight from Florida, but I thought that was that the one? Was that the CR? Did that launch from Florida? There was one that just went up tonight. It was supposed to go around 5:30 or so, Eastern time. And then, you know, all these hours later, now it's 3 o'clock in the morning, you're going to have the launch from the Vulcan rocket that's going to go up. That's the one I'm interested in. So my guess is probably tonight. I didn't think that was a cargo mission, though. Back to you.
Yeah, okay, very good. I was having a conversation here. Yeah, that might have been this evening. I won't really look at deeper, sitting in one of the bars here and not really concentrating on the nomenclature as to exactly when it was, but that's possible that that was the one this evening and they put it up right away. It was kind of spectacular. And you said there's a launch in the wee hours of the morning. I guess we may hear it from here, but there's so much noise from the entertainment on the ship, and I don't know. I don't know if I'll hear the roar. We might. And I saw something on YouTube speculating that Starship might go this week. What have you seen on that? Go ahead.
Tested out a new Starship, and they ran the engines and as well as the boosters. They did it separately, so now I guess they'll put them together and hope for a clearance from the government. But I'm not sure when that's going to go. But yeah, the one that's going up tonight is 2:18 in the morning. But I don't know how far you are from Merritt Island.
Yeah, we're headed to the south. Around Cuba to Falmouth, Jamaica, so we're pretty far from there, but not during the speed spacecraft fly. And they do fly downrange over the Caribbean, so it's possible we'll hear it, and if I were up at that hour, might see it go overhead if they're firing downrange or toward the equator, which I think is what they usually do for the most advantage. Go ahead.
Yeah, they're looking to get into the same inclination plane as the moon, which I'm trying to visualize that now. But generally, they've got to go east. But I'm not sure what inclination they're going to use. I don't, you know, it's not a mission where, I know, like some of the SpaceX missions, they head directly your way, right? I mean, they start heading for Cuba. But if you're going up to Jamaica halfway there, I don't know. If you're up, go on the top deck and see if you can see a light up in the air. And that would be the brand new Vulcan rocket. Brand new, ULA is built. It's got two brand new BE-4 engines on it, built by Blue Origin. Engines have never flown before. The whole rocket has never flown before. They have a lander on board called Peregrine, built by Astrobotic. And that will be eventually heading to the moon. So it'll be the first lunar landing vehicle for the United States since 1972, Frank. Anyway, back to you. I'm looking at the time. I'm starting to...